Session number 7363, George Jameson, part 21.
Did you ever have the chance to see a German dugout?
Oh, several. Yes, many of them.
How did they compare with ours?
Well, of course, first of all, you've got to realise that the Germans had access to all the material that they needed. They'd overrun quite a lot of France. They could cut down trees. They could get timber. They could get everything from the ground in France. We couldn't. You see, they took it for nothing. Or if they took it at all, you see, they took it with paper money, which was no good anyhow. They said it was all right, but nobody thought it would be. In our case, anything we had to, that we needed in that direction, we had to pay for, and pay for with very hard currency. So that the Germans, to begin with, therefore, as a start, had everything that they needed to make the jobs, and they were skilled engineers. The dugouts they built were marvelous things. They were beautifully constructed. They were not only beautifully constructed, but they were skillfully constructed in the exits that they would have, so that people needn't be nailed in anywhere. If one entrance was blocked, people could scuttle out somewhere else. They could come up even holes in the ground at a distance away. They were very, very clever at all that, and their dugouts were absolutely perfection. Apart from the fact that the entrances faced the wrong way, whenever we attacked and got ground and we took over German dugouts, we occupied them, no question. And the infantry did too. Our battalions would head for the German dugout, even though they knew it would be marked on a German map and be likely to be well plastered. They might try and make an exit out some other way, but, you know.
Do you think that accounted for their very good performance?
Yes, I did, because you see another thing, they could hide in these holes, they could allow, they got very wise to our attack procedure, and they could stand up to an opening barrage and then bob up as soon as the lift took place and be there to fight, and up with the machine guns as well.
Did you ever meet any Germans? You mentioned the prisoners, which you sort of sent behind you because you were so busy going forward. But did you ever come face to face?
No. I never met any to sort of swap lies with. Never. Oh, the only times I say that they appeared were when they were prisoners, and then the job was to get rid of them as quickly as possible. That was all.
What do you think they excelled at most from your own experience?
I think they were brilliant soldiers. Some of their generals weren't quite so good, but by and large, I'd say their generals were very good. Their strategy was good. The way they planned to take places didn't come off very often, but the way they approached the job was, I would say, rather better than ours in many ways. Whether they'd had experience, I don't know where they would get it. But they were first-class soldiers. They were first-class equipped soldiers. And they were equipped, as I said before, more as a fighting unit, in my view, than we were. Because if you wanted to do something and you had infantry troops and you wanted to use engineering skills as well, their companies had these little nuclei with them as a unit. They were a homogeneous unit in that way, that they would have engineers, bombers, miners, everything all in the one company under the one man. Much better than having to get in touch. And you see what happened, and got to admit it, in the war. You had a lot of top rank jealousy at times, trying to get somebody to do something, and it was more than going to be a favor instead of the fact that you want to press on with the campaign. So, you see, our people weren't equipped with the machine guns, the Germans were, and it took us a long time to have the Lewis gun and things like that. I met on a gunnery course on the coast. I met a fellow called De Brune, whose cousin was the man who invented the. The Germans bought it from him. The Germans acquired from him inventions which he had previously before the war offered to the British, and they didn't take them. If I could leave that for a minute, I might come back and think about it. But the Germans were very alive to acquiring things of that sort, and we didn't. We rather tended to think that we knew better very often, and we didn't.
Would you say they were more advanced in their technology overall?
I think yes, because I think they were more a military nation than we were. They were a bigger country, of course, than Britain, and they had a bigger standing army, and they had, with the Kaiser getting these militaristic ideas of his, they'd been expanding that army just as they did in the Second World War preparation, building it up beforehand, building up their battleships beforehand, their strength generally. But they were, the Prussian officer was an elitist, you see. They were somebody. They were the Hygieians. You got off the pavement when he walked along. That kind of thing. Now, that attitude in Germany promoted a military nation, so that the whole drift was in that direction. And they had, as I say, they had this big standing army.
Were they good at sniping?
Yes, very. They evolved the sniper's art long before we were anywhere like it, and they took darn good care that a sniper wasn't just a first-class shot and could hide himself among bushes and trench fronts and whatnot. They opened up a little aperture, and then they got a special plate which would just allow enough space for the rifle to go through and an eye hole to see through. And they were, the man behind the thing was well protected, so even if anybody shot at him, it was 10-1 they wouldn't be able to kill him, because he'd got a bit of an armor plate in front of him. Now, they developed all that long before we ever thought of it. Just as they developed the use of different grenades in a variety of directions before we really spread ourselves out enough. And just again, as they developed the use of signal lighting, right up to the end of the war, they had far more signal by lights than we ever had.
Oh, yes, I think you've explained the...
All those things were much more widely alerted to the uses and the needs of things, and I must say I envied them very much, their telephone gear, which was much neater than ours and much more efficient.
Yes, you have explained how up-to-date that was. Was it obvious when their morale had cracked at the end of the war? Could you sort of see a point where the...
Yes, gone. Yes, we did. We began to have the sense that they were cracking.
What were the signs of that?
There wasn't the sort of determination to press on with it in quite the same way. There wasn't the sort of determination to hold on to it in quite the same way. Although, even at right up to the end, in odd scraps every here and there, you got the bunch that were diehards anyhow, and they were just going to see you out if they could. But overall, as I told you about Drew Common, their morale was going down because they were very badly fed. They were being gradually, our warfare in that direction was taking a grip on them. We were starving them. The nation was starved. The German population were on very much starvation rations, and the army went very much better towards the end. And I think that more than anything is saps any army's morale when they can't get food. They certainly, as Drew said, they're not getting any meat, you know. And it's quite true. I mean, it's quite simple, but it was very obvious. They must have been... You see, their coffee was ersatz stuff. They never got any coffee. All the things like that were sawdust. There was one rumor that went around in the war that the Germans were using corpses and sending them off to vats and melting them down for the glue. I know that was a superstition that went around. I never saw anything of evidence to support that, except this: that they were very expert in saving labour by running Decavel railways up to the front, so that you didn't have to lug a lot of stuff over rough terrain and perhaps muddy terrain. If they got this little light railway run up, they could put a truck on it and load all the stuff on and push it very much more easily. Well, on one occasion when he'd overrun a front and we were getting well on, we came across the German Decavel Railway, and on one truck there were a bundle of dead bodies, more or less wired together in about sixes, piled onto these trucks. Now, whether it was, you see, it's not fair to judge them, because whether it was that these people had been killed, and therefore whatever they were wearing was of value, and if they were short of stuff, they had to be stripped. Whether it was that they were being stripped for that reason, so that they could win back all the uniforms, the boots and everything else, and use them for somebody else. And in any case, it was a better thing to get the bodies off the battlefield because it was more hygienic. I don't know. That could be the interpretation. But the rumour had it, just as lots of rumours did, that the Germans were collecting the corpses and sending them back to brewery vats and having them rendered down because they were very short of glue. And glue of some sort that seemed to be essential for explosives.
Were there many other rumours about them?
Oh, well, of course, there were the odd rumours about different things, like the Russians arriving with snow in their boots, which was a load of baloney.
Did you make a lot of jokes at the Germans' expense? And songs?
No, I don't think we bothered, you know. I don't think we bothered.
How about the songs on the front? You know, did you make up your own? The men made up their own songs?
Oh, there were all kinds of rude versions to very well-known tunes, you know. In fact, in that book of Lynn MacDonald's, she recites quite a number of songs, and some of them I never heard, quite frankly. But, yes, they were... When we were in Italy, you see, they got the wagon line, the drivers got singing a sort of tune that they'd heard the Italians singing, and they couldn't find any words to it, but they'd happened to get the numbers 1 to 10, so they used to sing the numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 to this tune. Uno, duo, tre, cinque, tre, nove, that sort of thing, you see. And then somebody would fit in a few rude lines to the end of it or something. Oh, there was always variations like that, and no lack of wit circulating.
I suppose the language was pretty strong too at times, was it?
Yes, very much down to earth. Blunt language, not particularly obscene in any way. No, more just straightforward blunt language. I mean, the kind of swear word which was common, which was part of the vocabulary of people living in different parts of this country. I mean, in the north, for instance, on Tyneside, bugger is a term of endearment. You see, it's not in lots of other places. They were down to earth and all that, but not, I wouldn't say they were disgustingly so. It was just blunt expletives.
How about motor transport at the front? Was there much about it?
Oh yes, all the rations were brought up by heavy lorries. In the very early days, when we were riding, I think we were on our way. Very early days, when must have been when we were on the way from Bruges or round about that area. We were riding along a road, a Belgian road, ditches on either side. These tall trees at intervals all the way along, and suddenly coming towards us was a string of London buses with all the signs on them, theatres and whatnot, everything, you see. And the horses sort of took one look at this and turned and leapt into the field, you see. We had no option. They just swung and jumped before we could really take hold, because we never thought they would just back off a bus. And then when we sort of circulated round, here these things went along. Now, where those buses were going, I don't know. I do know that the French used buses to rush up troops to the defence of Paris on one occasion. These troops had so-and-so at the Gaiety and this sort of thing, great plasters all over. And, of course, we were tickled pink to see all these London buses. with their London signs and the theatre and everything on. About six of them passed us, and then we got back onto the road and went on our normal business. That's the only time I saw any comic transporter, shall I say. But apart from that, all the heavy stuff came up by lorry. Geoffrey Rackham, who was a co-director of mine at Shelburgh and Drury, he was in command of a squad of these lorries, serving ammunition to the guns, he won the Albert Medal. As a matter of fact, the Germans shelled the place, and he had to not only get these things off the road, but get them started. And he was jumping into one after another and get them going and wheeling them away and getting men out of the way. And he got the Albert Medal in gold, which is it was an unusual decoration. Strangely enough, his brother-in-law, he married Dr. Scurfield in Letchworth, and her brother, Commander Scurfield, was in the Navy. He had Peter Scott on his destroyer in the Med, and he'd won an Albert Medal in gold because he rammed his destroyer in the Atlantic in a terrific storm. They couldn't take anybody off by boarding. They ran this thing hard up against this liner, which was slowly sinking, with the bows held up there like that, while they got people jumping across and got all the crew off that thing before it sank. He got the Albert Medal in gold as well. And Scruffy said to Geoffrey Rackham when she first got to know him, I've never heard about anybody having that before until I meet you and my brother's got it. It was funny.
How about motorcycles? Were there many motorbikes?
Yes, all the DRs, divisional DRs and battalion DRs rode motorcycles. The Douglas was it was a little twin Douglas, were a very, very popular bike, and they were used quite a lot in the war.
Did you have one at all, or did you keep to your horse?
No, we never got them. We were used as message carriers of one sort or another, and expected to get there and back on whatever means we could without being given anything.
How about aircraft? You've mentioned aircraft in Italy, and particularly the drunken pilots.
Yes, and of course the...
What was the situation in France regarding both sides, the use of aircraft?
Von Richthofen, you see, he... we saw him quite a lot, his Red Devil and his flying Fokkers. That's the name, Fokker. Fokker was, he invented that. And he was de Brune's cousin. And that Fokker design was offered to the British. And they didn't take it. And Fokker was the thing that the Germans knocked hell out of our people. We had Sopwiths, FE-8s, all sorts of aircraft, but we were primitive compared with them. They were well ahead of us in aircraft. Even although at some time they were firing revolvers at each other from, you know, to begin with. But later we got the de Havillands. De Havillands produced the Sopwith Camel and the Sopwith Pup and those things, and the RNAS flew those. But even so, the Fokkers were much more manoeuvrable than ours were, and they shot an awful lot of our people out of the sky. You used to see these things regularly float up above and take two or three of our observation planes out. And as I say, it was tragic that de Brune told me his cousin had offered these plans to the British before the war, and then he'd gone to Germany.
This von Richthofen, the Red Baron.
Mm-hmm, that's him.
What's his plane bright red?
Red, bright red. You would always recognise it
if he was. Quite a lot.
Oh yes, quite a lot. We saw him quite a few times.
What sort of exploits? What would he do then?
Well, he was leading a squadron of fighters, and they would take on anything that was going around the sky. And he was quite something. I mean, You see, our people were generally doing observation work, and they were just sitting ducks for people like that. We saw lots of our people go down.
Were they of considerable nuisance value to the infantry, the British infantry?
Yes.
Did they come along and gun and bomb you?
They used to, mainly their role was to shoot out observation or reconnaissance planes in the sky to prevent them seeing what was going on behind, or to protect a plane that was doing photographing work over the trenches or wherever to find out what was going on there, to be alert to the fact that preparations for a battle might be coming off and all that sort of thing. So that the actual fighting was the fighter aircraft putting down the eyes of the army, and whether it was that or balloons, the same things were to happen. They would go, you'd see them come over behind you, and suddenly with a balloon behind you would see smoke coming from it, and out from the basket would come the observer with his parachute, you see. And what they occasionally did was, which was a dirty trick we thought, was to circle round the place shooting at the fellow in the parachute. We didn't like that. We thought that wasn't quite jonic. Something came to my mind there. Two positions. One of these aircraft was shot down at Jerry, as a matter of fact, came down, and the fellow came into our mess and surrendered. Drew was there and the others, and I was told about it, but he landed, shot up enough but he could land, he came down on there. And the other thing that was unpleasant, I've never felt more like a rabbit than on this occasion. And then I was walking back, I don't know where it was on the front, but I can remember it was open country and there wasn't much in the way of trench communication. It was a brilliant, lovely, fine day. And there were two of us coming back, and suddenly we saw this aircraft sail over, and he went away beyond us and then circled round and came back again, and then suddenly he dived at us and this machine gun opened up. And of course, having a little bit of knowledge of what happens, as soon as we got this sort of line of where he was aiming at, we ran off at a right angle. And then as soon as we'd gone so far there, he would swerve, you see. We were running in another way, and all this time we were, he'd been up machine gunning group fortifications or something, and he'd spotted us, and he thought, I think he must have thought he'd have a joyride. Then he fairly put the wind up us. We were, I never felt more like a rabbit. First of all, running in one direction, diving behind something, and then when he'd come shooting off, as he was coming this way, you'd suddenly shoot off in the other direction quicker than he could turn, you see. And this went on for about 10 or 15 minutes before he got sick of it and went away. But in the meantime, he fairly scared the pants off us.
Could I ask you now about the volunteer and the conscripted British troops? Did you notice any great difference between the two types? I think you said earlier you were mostly dealing with regulars, weren't you?
Yes. Yes, you see, we were a territorial unit in a regular army, you might say. They were there for the job, and they'd been trained for the job, so that there was no question about it. Later on, well, the volunteer business didn't last very long, because presently they were conscripted. There was no question of people volunteering. While the volunteers were coming along, of course, there were. Mind, some of the volunteers realized that things weren't quite what they'd looked forward to, and they didn't quite like it. And also, there were quite a lot of conscripted people who were brought in as a result of conscription, who turned out to be first class. As I say, it was an amazing thing that war brought out in certain people where you least expected the most extraordinary qualities. Amazing.
Well, you certainly had an opportunity to show your qualities, Mr. Jameson.
Oh, no more.
I wonder, when you look back at this period, what do you think the main effects have been of the First World War on your life? Did you learn any valuable lessons from this?
Yes, I learned a great deal about dependency upon other people and comradeship and the joy of meeting making first-class friends. That you didn't matter where you would meet them again, they would still be, they were friends of yours. Apart from that, I looked upon it as a very wasted area of my life. And I was extremely lucky to come through it with a whole skin. But there were an awful lot of friends of mine who didn't. You only had to look around the female population after the war to realize just how many marriages, engagements and whatever had gone wide. There were an awful lot of girls that were never married after the First World War, simply because they were of an age group where they'd had friends and husbands and whatnot that lost, which was extremely sad. Waste of life, I think, waste of life, and achieves nothing. And you never win. In fact, you're better off if you lose, because everybody jumps to help you onto your feet again, whereas when you win, you're expected to help somebody else, and you haven't got the guts or the wherewithal to do it. No.
Well, Mr. Jameson, thank you very much indeed for sharing your experiences with us.
Well, I can only say thank you very much. It's been a most enjoyable experience for me. I'd never have thought either that people would be sufficiently interested to keep me talking as long, or that I should meet somebody on the same wavelength with me that would make me talk. I have enjoyed it immensely. It's a wonderful experience. I'm very grateful.